Okay, so we're on for Pentateuch, but we're going through the judgments. So we've gone through, of course, the children of Israel coming up to Mount Sinai and God, you know, warning them in advance, but still it's hard to be ready for God coming down on the mountain and speaking, which scared him half to death. And then he called Moses aside. You know, I always take it as an assumption that he didn't thunder and make everything shake and all that while he's giving Moses these three chapters of judgments. Because if he did, probably Moses would be too nervous to write any of it down. But that's just a guess. But we've gone through a couple chapters. So we're going to pick up with chapter 23. And as I said, you know, this seems to be somewhat of a combination of statutes and perhaps case law. You know, looking at, you know, here's what you do if and when this happens. With the presumption that maybe a lot of these things had happened, or maybe they'd had to deal with some of these questions. So we're going to pick up in chapter 23, pretty simple, straightforward instruction. You shall not circulate a false report. So be honest. Don't put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. It's interesting. Basically, this all together saying, you got to do what's right. You got to speak the truth, stand up for what's right, and don't be influenced either by the rich or by the poor. Now, don't show partiality to the poor, which you could say, you know, our modern governments in Western society have tended to do that to some degree. It's worth noting that where it says crowd, you shall not follow a crowd. The Hebrew word there, it says, is rabim. R-A-B-B-I-M. Which could also be translated as powerful people or chiefs. And in the context, it could be saying, yeah, don't be led astray by these influential, powerful people. At the same time, don't show partiality to the poor people. And there's going to say, stay, you know, I would say down the middle, but the middle is not always correct. But God is saying, you know, do what's right. You know, don't show partiality either to rich or poor. And he goes on, describes, you know, do the right thing, even if it's for somebody you don't like. In verse 4, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, bring it back to him again. Don't say, well, I'd catch the wild, you know, the donkey going astray, but I really hate that guy, so I'm not going to help him out. God says, no, do help him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you, so, you know, whether you hate him or he hates you, lying under its burden, and you would refrain from helping it, no, you shall surely help it. You know, the donkey's basically got stumbled and it can't get him. The donkey's got one, doesn't have the button, you know, for help, I've fallen and I can't get up. So you got to go help it get up. That never crossed my mind before just now, but, and nobody seems to think it's funny. Is that commercial not on the air anymore? Or is it just not funny to talk about? No, guess not. I think it's still on. Yeah, Life Alert. Yeah, I don't mean, my grandma used to have one of those. And which is funny, she would never use it if she needed it, but she pushed the button once in the middle of the night because she heard a funny noise outside, not realizing they would call me at 2 in the morning to go check it out. Anyways, let's get back on track here. Yeah, verse 6, do not pervert the judgment of the poor in your pervert the judgment of your poor in his dispute. Keep yourself far from a false matter. Do not kill the innocent and the righteous, for I will not justify the wicked. And don't have a double standard, as I said, even if it's for the poor. In verse 8 it says, and take no bribe. A bribe blinds the discerning and perverts the words of the righteous. And it's sad to say, I've heard, and I haven't lived there, but I've heard that there are some countries in the world where giving or taking bribes is just part of doing business, especially with the government, that it's kind of expected in some parts of the world. But God condemns it and seems to be saying, even if it is normal, and I would say it's not normal here, it's not normal to do it openly in the United States. And I hope that it's not normal at all. As I said, I've never gone to the DMV to get my license renewed, and they want me to give them a little sweetener, as it's called. Or I think the French, a douceur. That, anybody speak French? Good, nobody's going to correct me. It comes to mind, I remember Yeah, the XYZ affair back in the 1700s. The French ambassadors are asking for a little sweetener to be able to meet with the Secretary of State, and the Americans were totally outraged, which they should have been, because they read the Bible and thought, hey, it's wrong. We shouldn't be paying bribes, shouldn't be accepting bribes. And of course, as it says, a bribe would blind the discerning. Going on to verse 9, also you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. So you know what it's like, you know, treat other people properly. And he goes on then to introduce the land Sabbath. 6 years you shall sow in your land and gather in its produce, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat it, and that they may leave, and what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. In like manner you'll do with your vineyard and your olive grove. Okay, so the land Sabbath, more information will be given about that in Leviticus chapter 25. So if you want to make a reference there, Leviticus 25 verses 2 through 6. And this is something many of you are familiar with. You might have practiced it yourself or have family members. God basically says, okay, every seventh year, don't work the land. By let it lie fallow means don't plow it, don't harvest it, just leave it alone. Now, some stuff will grow up on its own. And he's saying, leave it. Don't go out there. Let the poor of the land. So this is sort of supplementing like a social services type of program. You know, the poor people can go out and gather food, and you know, the animals can gather it if necessary. And what isn't eaten will improve the fertility. You know, stuff will, yes. Leviticus 25, verses 2 and 6, 2 through 6. Of course, aside from the fact that it's going to benefit the land, what is this also doing? Oh, I said benefit the land, benefit the poor people, Matt. Okay, it frees the hired servants. Yeah, it gives them a rest. Oh, you're thinking of when Yeah, actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because there is some question. It would make sense if it's on the same cycle. But there isn't any place I've seen where it seems absolutely certain that it is on the same cycle. But to me, I've always presumed it probably was, that, you know, the one of the main reasons it might not be is once they started planting their land, it seems in ancient Israel the idea was everyone would keep the land Sabbath at the same time. So it would be the land Sabbath for me, land Sabbath for you, because they all started planting, and it was an agrarian society where everybody had to plant. It's not like that for us today. Like if you buy a piece of land, like when Sue and I bought our first house, we lived there a year, and the next summer came around, we said, let's put in a garden. So it's funny, when there's let's put in a garden, it's always Frank that's having the shovel. I remember that when I was a teenager, my mom said, we need a garden, and handed me the shovel. Go out and dig up the land. But so what we did is we planted for so many years, and then seventh year comes around, you don't plant. But my in-laws have a garden as big as this room, and they're on a different cycle. They plant for 6 years, and then seventh, leave it go. So throughout the church, you'll have different people keeping a land Sabbath at different times. And that seems perfectly normal. We're following the spiritual principle. There's value in doing that. There's value for the land. And one of the things I wanted to point out, it's also a test of faith. Because, matter of fact, in Leviticus 25, actually I want to turn over there. If I remember what it says, Leviticus 25 and verse 20 raises an interesting question. Yeah, Leviticus 25 verse 20 says, and if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year, since we shall not sow or gather our produce? The answer comes in verse 21. Then I, God, will command my blessing on you in the sixth year. It'll bring forth enough produce for 3 years. So basically, you're going to gather so much in the sixth year, you'll eat it the rest of that year, the next year, and the next, so that year 8, which is actually year 1 in the 7-year cycle, you plant, and at the end of that year, you harvest it. So it's a test. Is God really going to give me enough? It's kind of like the manna. As they were in the wilderness, every Friday or every 6th day, they'd go out and gather twice as much and hope and pray that it wouldn't have worms in it the next morning. I shouldn't say hope and pray. They probably got used to it very quickly that it didn't. But it was a test of faith, because it's not going to be out there the next day. Okay, and it works the same way in years. So God is saying, test me in this. And later on, we'll see that God would build from this into what's called a Jubilee year. Every 50th year, they would proclaim liberty, and there would be an extra land Sabbath. Because year 49 would be a land Sabbath. He'd say, now 50 is an additional one. And it's this great celebration and all that, but it's hinged on that everybody's keeping it at the same time. So when God's giving these laws to Israel, it's countrywide. So it's a little difficult for us to grasp, or maybe it's not that difficult, we just don't naturally think of that. But I wanted to give us that feeling of what's going on with this. Okay, so they're keeping the land Sabbath. It's a benefit for everybody. We go on in verse 12. He says, 6 days, so he's tying this back to the weekly Sabbath. 6 days you'll do your work, and on the seventh you shall rest. So it's not only you, but also your ox and your donkey, your servants, and the stranger will be refreshed. So the Sabbath is not only for those who are in control. It's not only for factory owners. It's for factory floor workers, you could say. Although he's not making any reference to factories because there weren't any as far as we know. And you could say allowing others to keep the Sabbath is a form of not oppressing them. You know, you're letting them have this time off. I'll mention in verse 13, and all that I've said to you, be circumspect. So pay attention to what I'm talking about. And make no mention of the name of other gods, nor let them be heard in your mouth. Now, I'm pausing here because it sounds like, oh, it's a sin if I mention the name of a false god. Would you make that presumption? Because if so, we've sinned in this room then. Yeah, Andrew? You're going to make the case. Not only that, but it's in the Bible. Like 1 Samuel 5 and verse 2 mentions Dagon. It's written out. And there are several places you see Baal or Ashtaroth. And Jeremiah later we'll talk about mentions the Queen of Heaven. I think what God is saying here is don't acknowledge the existence of these fictional beings as though they were real. Realize that it's just a fiction. He's saying don't treat it as though they are actual gods. So I think that, and it's not just me, most scholars say that's what this is getting at. Not the actual pronunciation of a particular name. Because, you know, what if there's a false god, its name is Nathan? Then I can't address Nathan by his name because it's also the name of the false god, which I'm being silly, but the point is it's not the pronouncing a word that's evil, it's the intent behind it. So having said that, I'll move on. Verse 14, actually for several verses here, we're going to introduce the other holy day seasons. Going into the Passover, God introduced the spring holy day season, as we call it, you know, Passover and the days of unleavened bread. Here it says, three times in the year you'll keep a feast to me. Keep the feast of unleavened bread. Eat no unleavened bread for 7 days. Eat unleavened bread for 7 days, as I commanded you at the point of time in Abib, for you came out of Egypt, none appear before me empty. So it's a reminder of you were doing this. Now he moves ahead. And in the feast of the harvest of first fruits of your labor, which you've sown in the field, and at the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you've gathered the fruit of the field. Three times in a year, all your males will appear before the Lord your God. So, again, they already had the spring festivals. Now we have the feast of the first fruits, as it's called, or the first fruits of your labors, which we know as Pentecost. We call it Pentecost later because God will, in Leviticus 23, give the calculation of when it is. Here he's just referencing it. And then later the fall festival season, which will consist of trumpets, atonement, tabernacles, and the eighth day. So again, here isn't all the detail, but he's making the point that you could say this is part of your national law as well as your religious law. We think of the holy days as permanent spiritual commands. But here God is saying, yeah, but it's also a national holiday. It's kind of like in the United States of America, Christmas is a national holiday, you know, and it's a holiday for people who don't believe in Christmas or anything like that. And we have other national holidays that are on the calendar. That makes sense? Okay. Moving on then. Verse 18. Don't you guys love just going through law stuff? Some of us do. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor shall the fat of my sacrifice remain till morning. So this seems to likewise write into the national law some of the regulations for the sacrifices. It's interesting because he hasn't specified what sacrifices to offer, but he's saying when you do sacrifice, make sure you don't leave the fat till morning, don't use leavened bread. And he goes on, the first of the first fruits of your land you'll bring to the house of the Lord your God. And don't boil a young goat in its mother's milk, which seems to just be out of the blue. And you're saying, don't what? There's a couple of interpretations on that. The first fruits, God has already addressed that a couple of times. One interpretation that I'm certain is not correct, and you can prove it from the Bible, but which Orthodox Jews adhere to, and that is they believe that God forbade having meat and dairy together. And you've probably heard of that. That's one of the fundamental of what they call kosher laws. You can't have meat and dairy together. So if you eat a cheeseburger, you're committing a great sin. Is that what this says? Okay, it's not what it says. I don't think that's the underlying meaning. One interpretation is that it's just simply saying, don't be cruel. You know, cooking a baby goat in its own mother's milk is kind of creepy and mean. And it also, some people who emphasize that say it would be like using as an instrument of death that which is supposed to give life. You know, the milk from the mother is life-sustaining and life-giving, and here you're using it to boil, the young. So a lot of, that's an interpretation many people have looked at. There's another one that's not based on anything in Scripture, but from studying the culture and history of the time. And some scholars say that in the pagan, part of the pagan religion that was common among the Canaanites, where they were planning to go, was that at the end of a harvest season, so they've gathered in the harvest, what they would do is they would slaughter a baby goat, boil it in its mother's milk, and make a broth out of that, and then they'd go sprinkle it on the fields and on the trees in the orchard and such to promote fertility, so they'd have good crops next year. And God is saying, don't do that. Those pagans are doing that. They think that's appealing to some false god. I'm not that false god, and I don't work that way. And that's, in the United Church of God, we've leaned towards that as the why we think it's in here. It's worth mentioning that particular command shows up 3 times in the Pentateuch. And I think because it was something that was fairly common. It'll show up again. Oh, no, it's something else I was looking at. So any questions on that? Okay, if not, verses 20 to 22, he says, behold, I'll send an angel before you to keep you in the way and bring you into the place that I've prepared. Beware of him. Obey his voice. Don't provoke him. He won't pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if you indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, I'll be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, well, all the Ites. And while we're mentioning the Ites, I'll just mention a little trivia fact. The Septuagint version adds Girgashites, even though the Girgashites aren't mentioned here. But that rounds up all of the Ites that were around there, all the Canaanites. The fact that they're not mentioned here, and they had been earlier in Genesis, some people think they'd either been exterminated or married into other tribes and disappeared, and most of us aren't too worried about what happened to the Girgashites. The bigger question is, who's this angel? That it's going to have God's name, and you got to listen to what he says. Any thoughts? Okay, first thought is it could be Christ, the pre-incarnate Christ known as the Word. He's right there in the pillar of cloud and pillar of fire, and that's one of the two most likely interpretations. The other one I'll mention is that this is based on the idea where it says angel. What's the Hebrew word there? Malak, which means messenger, translated into angel, which comes from, Greek, and then later in Latin. But Malak can be any messenger. That word is used to pertain to Jesus Christ. It's used to refer to angels. But there are places where it refers to human messengers for God. So there are some scholars that read over those verses and say, oh, he's talking about Moses and later Joshua or whoever it is that God puts in charge leading them to the promised land. And I see that as a viable possibility. In some ways, it makes more sense Because he says, my name is in him, but he says, he won't pardon your transgressions. Well, if it's a human person, well, they wouldn't be able to, per se. But Jesus Christ did have the ability to pardon transgression. So that's the main thing that would lean towards saying maybe it was referring to a human. But some of the other things make you think someone of a higher power than just Moses or Joshua. I think either way it still works out. Obey, follow what they say, don't cause trouble, and everything will be all right. Oh, I already talked about the Girgashites. Don't you guys like it when I talk about Girgashites? You should practice saying it. It's fun. Yeah, well, moving on. I didn't read verse 24. Well, actually, we'll go on because he's talking about going in and conquering the land, as he says in verse 24. Don't bow down to their gods or serve them. Don't do according to their works. Completely overthrow them. Break down their sacred pillars. So you shall serve the Lord your God, and he'll bless your bread and water. I'll take away sickness. No one will suffer miscarriage. You won't be barren. I'll fulfill your days. He's saying if you get rid of that false evil worship, things are going to be great. I'll send my fear before you and cause confusion among the people. Make your enemies turn their backs. And I'll send hornets before you, which will drive out the Hivite and the Canaanite and the Hittite before you. He says, I won't drive them out in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous. But little by little, I'll drive them out before you until you have increased and inherit the land. Okay, so again, God says, I want a clean slate. Get rid of those people. Get rid of their forms of worship. Don't save them and put them in museums. Don't say, oh, they're worshiping, Ishtar here, so I'm going to use that same spot to worship God. He didn't want that. And you could see there's a little foretaste of the blessings and cursings chapters. And those are in, of course, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. But he's saying, if you obey me, wonderful things happen to you. If you disobey, bad things will happen. And we usually zip right past that, although that's by far the most important thing. And then we ask the question, well, where are the hornets? Were there real hornets or not? And the answer is, we don't know. Some people say, yeah, there were hornets that were driving off the people, but it's not mentioned here because the Israelites weren't where they were. Others would say it's more likely that that's symbolic. And God is saying, if you trust me, you won't have to fight. Which seems to indicate they didn't trust God so much, because later under Joshua, they did have to fight. One of the things I find interesting is, if you remember the very first week we were here, I talked about the change of climate and landscape and what is the promised land. This is one of the places I turn to where it says, if you don't have people there keeping down the population, the wild carnivores will increase dramatically. Well, for there to be that many carnivores, like bears and lions and such, there have to be a pretty large number of herbivores for them to prey upon. For there to be a large number of herbivores, there have to be a large number of herbs, a lot of plant life for them to eat. And that's a roundabout way of saying it seems that the promised land was very productive, more so than we probably see it today and throughout most of the history we're familiar with. It really was flowing with milk and honey, but not really symbolically or metaphorically. That's the word I'm looking for. Okay, and he talks about the boundaries. Verse 31, I'll set your bounds from the Red Sea to the Sea of Philistia, and from the desert to the river. I'll deliver the inhabitants into your land. Make no covenant with them nor with their gods, which is what I said. God wants all those people moved out, lest they shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you to sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it'll be a snare to you. So God, he wanted the non-Israelites moved out. We want to emphasize not because they were inferior, not because they would never have a chance for salvation, but God wanted Israel to be separate. Which is part of the idea of separate is a root to the word holy. So I want you to be separated from the other people. You're going to be not like them for his particular purpose. But all those Hivites, Jebusites, Girgashites, they'll be raised up in the resurrection and have just as much a chance of salvation, in God's family as any of the rest of us. And he mentions, of course, basically this broad area is the land that he wanted to give to Israel. Now, during most of Israel's existence, they didn't have all of this land. Under David and Solomon, they did finally spread out to where they were, like from the Euphrates down to the border of Egypt, from the Mediterranean Sea over to the great desert. You know, at that point, they did expand over to that. Most of the time, they were hemmed in and governing much less land. I'm pausing because I'm at the end of a chapter. Now that's the end of the judgments. So we're going to move into chapter 24 and see what happens afterwards. You know, so he said to Moses, "Come up to the Eternal, you, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and 70 of the elders." Nadab and Abihu are Aaron's two oldest sons. Notice God hasn't yet mentioned that Aaron is going to become the high priest, but he already has it in mind, obviously. So basically God is, you know, he's given the judgments to Moses, and he's going to send him back to tell all the people. These are the terms of this covenant. If Israel agrees to it, bring all these people back and we'll have like a celebration together. So Moses came in verse 3 and told all the people the words of the Lord and all the judgments. And all the people answered with one voice, "All the words which the Lord has said we will do." And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the mountain with 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes. So you see, these terms of the covenant are presented and they're agreed upon. God doesn't force Israel. At this point, they could say, I don't think so. I think we'll go worship some other god. He's not so demanding. But they say, yeah, we'll do this. One thing I'll point out, so this is the covenant. It seems to consist of the Ten Commandments and these judgments and a promise to obey, which is kind of an open-ended commitment. But I want to reference this back to Jeremiah 7 and verse 22. I covered this when we went through that in class. I'll turn back there. Jeremiah 7, 22. God says, "I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices." You know, we haven't read about burnt offerings and sacrifices other than when you do sacrifice, you know, what? Don't leave it the fat till the next morning and don't use leavened bread with it. That's about it. He said, "But this is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice and I'll be your God and you'll be my people." So I just want to show, yeah, when he said that to Jeremiah, that's an accurate depiction. Right now, the sacrifices are sort of a separate thing from this covenant. And that fits with what I said in Ephesians, which scripture I don't have written down. Paul said they were added because of disobedience. But at any rate, there is going to be offering to help seal the covenant. Verse 5, "He sent 10 young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings. And Moses took the blood and put it in basins, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. He took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has said we will do." It's kind of like the man and woman standing at the front of all their family and friends with a minister, and he says, "Do you take this woman, you know, to care for her and all that?" "Yes, I do." "Do you promise to obey and love and support?" You know, like a wedding ceremony, you stand up, you have the terms of the covenant, and you say, "Yes, I do," and it's sealed. And that's what's going on here. In verse 8, "Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people," which I always thought was kind of gross, "and said, this is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to these words." So they you know, basically they're sealing the covenant. This is like a national marriage ceremony. And if you want, you could reference, there's a number of places where God says, "I was married to Israel," like in Jeremiah 3, verse 14. That was Jeremiah 3, 14, and Jeremiah 31, verse 32, and in Ezekiel 16, verse 8. And you don't have to have those memorized, but I'll also turn back to Jeremiah 34. Jeremiah 34, beginning in verse 18, seems to be referencing this. Jeremiah 34, 18 says, "I'll give the men who have transgressed my covenant, who have not performed the words of my covenant, which they made before me, when they cut the calf in two and passed between the parts of it, the princes of Judah and the princes of Jerusalem, the eunuchs, the priests, all the people who passed between the parts of the calf." Again, I find it interesting. It's described here in Jeremiah, but not here in Exodus. But maybe it did happen like that. Or you know, perhaps this section in Jeremiah is referring to a different time when they renewed the covenant. I lean towards believing that they did do this as part of the ceremony. They had these offerings. They got all the blood. It seems that they maybe probably cut the animals in half, and the princes, the elders, walked between them as part of this grand ceremony. That I can't prove, and it doesn't really matter one way or the other. The idea is they did seal the covenant with blood. So they made a commitment to God. God made a commitment to them. But as we've seen, Jeremiah, when God recounts it later, says, and you broke the covenant. They're going to break it in about a month, you know, more or less. And we'll read that fairly soon. But in the meantime, things are good. In verse 9, Moses went up also. Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and 70 of the elders of God. And they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, like the very heavens in its clarity. But on the nobles of the children of Israel he did not lay his hand. So they saw God, and they ate and drank. You know, this seems to describe, you know, like we've just had the marriage ceremony, now they're having the meal afterwards. Now, I don't know what, you know, the million or so other people don't necessarily get to come up and sit at the main table, but these guys come probably not at the peak of the mountain, but partway up the mountain, and they see something. What are they seeing? Or who are they seeing, I should ask? Or is it a difficult question? Must be pretty difficult. Or is it so simple? Now, it says they see God. Okay, we believe the pre-incarnate Christ was God and is God. Why would we say him, though, and not God the Father? Okay, let me give you some scriptural references for that. John 5 and verse 37. There are more, but woman, John 5, 37 and John 6, 48. I'm going to turn there. One of the reasons I'm doing it is because there's been some people, it seems, in recent years have said, I'm not so sure, I think this is God the Father. But for that to be true, it would seem to be contradicting what Jesus Christ says. Here in John 5:37, he says, the Father himself who sent me has testified of me. You've neither heard his voice at any time nor seen his form. Now, one question that comes up, some people say, wait, you never heard his voice at any time or seen his form. Some people would say, yeah, but who is Christ talking to? And he is talking to a group of the Pharisees at that particular time. So that's one way people say, well, maybe just they haven't, but other people have. But the next chapter in John 6, verse 48, is a little more conclusive. No, it's John 6, maybe that's 46. Sorry, I can't read my writing. Yeah. John 6, 46 says, not that anyone has seen the Father, except he who is from God, he has seen the Father. So Jesus Christ is telling people, look, I've seen him, but no one else has. That's pretty comprehensive. So this Aaron, Moses, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 other guys see someone, it's obviously not the Father, or else Jesus Christ was telling a fib. And I don't think that Jesus Christ told fibs. So it makes sense they're seeing the one who would become Jesus Christ. And that fits with the teaching that we've had in the Church of God for many decades, that the God who dealt with ancient Israel was the one we know as Jesus Christ. Not to say that the Father was not involved. The Father was intimately involved. But for, we could say whatever reasons, I think there were reasons, the one who would become incarnate as Jesus Christ did the interaction with them. And in some cases, people got to see him. You know, Abraham got to sit down and have a meal with him. You know, he wrestled with Jacob all night. So it's not that he was distant, nobody could see him, but the Father wasn't interacting in that particular way. But many places in the Old Testament where it refers to God, it's obvious that it is referring to the Father. So we also don't want to make the mistake, of thinking that the Father, you know, is off, you know, watching TV while Jesus Christ is running everything. Because there aren't any good programs on back then anyways, so. Yeah, and take levity for what it is, but this is a serious topic. And do you guys understand? I don't think it's that complex, but there are some passages where you can debate which one is it referring to. It's especially when we have the one word. There are places in the Old Testament where this is clearly talking about the pre-incarnate Christ. There are some places, though, where it seems to clearly be talking about God the Father. And some places it might be referring to both, you know, at the same time, or either or, and you're not certain. I'm comfortable with not always knowing for certain, you know, because it's only two of them it could be, so it's not like it could be just anyone.
So when we were talking about the angel that they were going to send, is it the pre-incarnate Christ saying he's going to send himself?
Well, that's one of the reasons I tend to lean towards thinking that might be referring to Moses as the Malak who he would send. And later he would work through Judges. I mean, here he seems to be referring to while they're wandering to bring them to the promised land. So, but it could be the fact that God's withholding, you know, it's like I could send whoever I want to send. You know, if Moses decides to mess up, I'm not committed to Moses. You know, well, he is committed to Moses, but, you know, Moses decides to check out, I'll raise up somebody else and work through him. An important lesson for all of us, you know, if for some reason I decide I'm not a very good teacher or suddenly I'm not a good teacher, they'll move me out of here and someone else will be in and probably have less corny jokes and such. But yeah, one of the things about the angel is, well, would Christ refer to himself in third person, I'm going to send myself? I would say it's not impossible, especially the vagaries of Hebrew, which they're only vague to me because I don't speak Hebrew. But ancient Hebrew is vague even to modern people who do. Okay. There's a couple other things to point out. One, this paved work of sapphire stone we see in verse 9. You can make a reference to some other places where we see something like that, especially in Ezekiel. Ezekiel 1 and verse 26 is a time where Ezekiel has this vision of seeing God. And he describes it similarly. Ezekiel 1 verse 26 says, above the firmament over their heads, and their heads there is some cherubim, says there was the likeness of a throne in appearance like a sapphire stone. And on the likeness of the throne was the likeness of the appearance of a man high above it. So, like a sapphire stone. Also, Ezekiel 10, verse 11. Oh, it's 10, verse 1. I'll also make a reference, Revelation chapter 15, verse 2 gives a similar description. And I'm only pointing this out to show that, okay, it seems to be not just some symbolic thing. This is what it looks like under God's throne. I'll raise the question because we'll be covering the first part of Ezekiel fairly soon, where Ezekiel has this image or this vision of seeing God sitting on a throne. I've heard it described as the portable throne. Like there's a throne that stays in heaven and God can, he gets on like his motorbike and zips down with a cherubim. Of course, I always raise the question, does it have to be a portable throne? Because if you're God, what's not portable? And I don't know the answer to that either. But they're seeing this, and other people hundreds of years later would see something similar. So there's some consistency with what God shows people. Anyways, and they're having this meal, as I said, it's kind of like a marriage feast. You could reference Revelation 19, verse 9. Revelation 19, 9 is where it says, blessed are they who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. So this was the marriage supper of the Lamb first time, before the wife was unfaithful and ruined the marriage. Okay, then, and as I said, this seems to be partway up the mountain, because in verse 12, the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I'll give you tablets of stone and the law and commandments which I've written that you may teach them. So all these people up there partway, having this nice meal, seeing God sitting up there, and I always presume that God is eating too, but it doesn't necessarily say it. And then when it's wrapped up, God says, Moses, I need you to come up here. Okay, I'm going to give you all this stuff. I've got it written down. I'm going to give you stone tablets with the law written on it. So Moses with his assistant Joshua, Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. So Moses tells them all, I got to go up there. You guys go back down. And he said to the elder, well, at first he said, wait here. I don't think he means wait right here where you are, but go down and stay camped at the base of the mountain where all the people are. So wait, we're going to go up, and it seems God might have let Moses know this is going to be a while. How long is it going to be? 40 days, it says at the very end of the chapter, 40 days and 40 nights. So he knows he's going to be gone a while. I'm not sure if he knows that yet, but he tells him, go on down, and Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man has a difficulty, let him go to them. So he's saying, I got to go talk to God. I'm putting Aaron and Hur in charge. So if you have any kind of problem, talk to them about it until I get back. Okay, we know who Aaron is, right? Who's Hur? Julia. Probably Miriam.
Maybe I didn't understand the question. You mentioned Aaron and Hur.
And yeah, and this is not H-E-R, it's H-U-R. So it's a proper name.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, never mind.
No, it's right here in, what is it, verse 14. Aaron and Hur are with you. Have we met Hur before? Yes. Remember when they were fighting Amalek and when Moses was staying praying and when his arms went down because they were heavy, you know, Israel would lose, but when they were up, so Aaron was on one side and Hur on the other holding up Aaron's arms. That was where we first met Hur. Here we see Hur again. And we're not going to hear from him again after this. So it's a big question. This guy's up there right next to Aaron as far as Moses saying he's in charge while I'm gone, and we don't know who he is. There is a Jewish tradition that may or may not be true. I find it intriguing. This Jewish tradition says he was Miriam's husband. So if so, he was Moses' brother-in-law. So my brother and my brother-in-law are in charge till I come back. And that seems to fit. And that same tradition will be tied to the incident of the golden calf that we'll be covering in the future. Because we know Aaron is closely involved with that. The people would come and say, make us gods. You know, where was Hur during that? One version of the story says Hur objected, so they killed him. And that was a strong motivation for Aaron to say, well, maybe I will help make this calf. But again, that's just legend and tradition that's not in the Bible. When I say just, well, I'm not saying that means it's false, but we can't prove that it's true. If it is true, it's kind of intriguing. But I want to put the rest of that off because we'll deal with Aaron and the golden calf incident when we come there. But again, as I said, we're left to guess about who Hur was. It's not an easy name to say, even though it's only three letters. Maybe it is easy, it's just we think of it as a pronoun. Anyways, let's wrap this up. So, verse 15, Moses went up into the mountain and a cloud covered. So, Moses, they see Moses and Joshua like disappear off into the fog. And they probably sit there and watch one and say, well, you want to go home, see what's on TV? Or, you know, so they head back down. The glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai. So, they see God's glory, perhaps the pillar of fire or something. And the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called Moses out of the midst of the cloud. So some people say maybe this waiting was some type of a purification period. So Moses is waiting, and then after 6 days of waiting on the seventh, God calls him up. The people see what probably looks like fire on the top of the mountain. They might have been really impressed at first, but we're going to see by the time 40 days go by, they're not so impressed, and they're saying, what happened to this Moses guy? I will mention, and I've got a note here, they might, before we get to the 40 days being up, when Moses comes back, they might have think, well, Moses probably died. You know, he went up there and he never came back. Deuteronomy 9 and verse 9, Deuteronomy 9:9 is where it tells us that Moses would not eat or drink for 40 days. So that meal they had with God must have been pretty good. But I think it was more than that. I think God sustained him, you know, but miraculously. Of course, we know Jesus Christ fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, and it said afterwards he was hungry. Never says that Moses is hungry, but I think God was giving him a little extra help here. But anyways, as I said in verse 17, they see the glory of the Lord like a consuming fire. Moses went in the midst of the cloud and went up in the mountain. And Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. And that's where he's going to be. And it's funny, the last couple years I've taught this class, we had it in the module in the first semester, and I'd say, and that's where we're going to leave it until the start of next semester, where we'll pick up with what God tells him. But I'll give you a hint. It's mostly about how to build the tabernacle.